just basically, I got into the infantry by scraping in under the, but they're on the gun crew, and I've got a photograph up there. You all have to be fair sized for manhandling the gun. And I said, well, I should be very disappointed if I've got to move out, and explained it through the comradeship and all the training I'd done. So he said, with the Sergeant Austin, wait outside.
Ben Whitchurch, end of reel one. Ben Whitchurch, reel two. So they asked you to wait outside.
Wait outside. So I sat down outside for probably some quarter of an hour, 20 minutes. And I was called in back into the company commander. He said, the only way you can stay in your anti-tank platoon, in your actual platoon, is to be promoted. I was surprised. Yeah, really surprised. I mean, what had I done to be promoted? He said, you're in a gun crew. He said, and Sergeant Austin has given you a good write-up, he said, and seeing you've got good friends in the actual gunnery that you've got, he said, do you accept the post of Lance Corporal to stay in the battery? So I said, certainly. So I became a Lance Corporal, a one striper.
Mm-hmm. Yes. How did the others?
Oh, no, I mean, they always call Lance Corporal a dog's hind leg for some reason or other. I don't know why, but I know I got on quite well. And because I was the smallest, I was the balance of the gun. That means get on the extended barrel on the end of the gun and physically hold on to it to balance the gun so they could maneuver it quicker. And that's what happened.
Useful in that.
Oh yes, in that respect, yes. And now they've decided to change the 6-pounder to a 17-pounder. Yeah, quite a big gun. And then we had to go to the station in Colchester with the track vehicles to pick up these 17-pounder guns. And when we saw them, we were dismayed. They were tremendous pieces of artillery. They were, yeah.
So, did you get the impression that everybody thought this would be a good move, these new guns? Or?
Well, the technology had moved on because of the learning to recognise tanks in their various forms, which you had to do. They showed you a little piece of a tank on a film. And you had to say, oh, well, that's a Russian T-34 or whatever. Sherman tank. No, there weren't Centurions running about in those. Yes, they were. Centurions. And they decided that the 6-pounder would be no good against the tank. So the 17-pounder, obviously, was a bigger shell, higher explosive, and could penetrate armour. So we now got to learn how to manhandle a big 17-pounder. It took weeks to learn how to use it, to manhandle it over.
Is it just the size of it?
Yes, the size. Physically, the gun crew was still the same, and it was so heavy. It took, as I say, weeks to get used to handling it. But it was all right. And then we went to the ranges, down to Castle Martin, over in Tenby, Salisbury Plain, firing it. Now, you haven't fired the gun yet. You've trained on it. You've done weeks of training, practicing shelling, put the shells in, stand back, fire. And there weren't no earmuffs in those days. No earmuffs, no earplugs.
So you've never
heard it? We've never heard it. We saw film of it, how it was being manhandled, and how to do this and how to that. And you could hear it on the screen, but not actually be in the vicinity where it actually fired. And when the first shell was fired, I think everybody fell down. It was tremendous, it was.
Were the procedures for loading? Was that
yes, it was a routine. No, yes, the same gun, yeah, same format. The distance, the elevation, whether it be a high explosive or an armour piercing. And the routine was identical. And each man had his own job to do. And you relied on each other. If one made a mistake, that made a mess up of the whole routine. So you had to know what you were doing, yes.
Yeah, so it's all about coordination.
Yes, coordination, yes.
So when you fired it, you were...
When we first fired it, yes, I remember that, because it was in, what is it, Beaufort, yeah. No, that was in Castle Martin, over in Wales. Because that was the only range it could take it in those days, because if the shell missed, it went out to sea. And there was a clear area of shipping, so if the shell didn't hit, and it ricocheted and went out to sea, it would cause any damage. We missed. Eventually, we started hitting targets. Yeah. I mean, when you fire your gun, it goes up, it lifts and goes all over the place, so it does disturb the trajectory of the shell, but eventually we did get it. But when the actual gun embedded in through firing, then you were able to hit targets. But it took several shots to get used to it, yeah.
What was it like in Castle Mountain? Was it quite bleak?
Bleak, open, yeah, it was one wild, bleak, open place, yes. No carpets on it. Just bare bunks and biscuits in the bed. The actual biscuits were mattresses about 2.5 feet square, and you had three of those on your bed. You had a sheet and a couple of blankets and a pillow, and that was your lot. Yeah. Not like today's army, I'm afraid.
So how long did you spend up?
3 weeks.
Mm-hmm. Enough, then.
Yes, quite enough. Yeah.
You felt quite confident by then.
Oh yes, by the time, and then we went down to Lawrence Cove as well. Mm-hmm. Down there firing, because it wasn't so far to travel. We did actually go firing live firing about 4 or 5 times, which wasn't bad considering. And as we got more used to the gun, we were hitting the target more. I mean, had we been put into battle in the beginning, the enemy would have won. You could never hit them. No. Yeah.
So, did you have any idea as to what the regiment or battalion would be doing next?
No. Nothing whatsoever.
You were just a member in
that. Yeah, just a member of a regiment. Then the Korean War obviously came into it, but at that particular time, no. I think, come towards the end, I was. Some 12 months into my service now. Yeah. And then it happened.
Yeah. And you heard about the Korean troubles?
Well, you heard about it, yes. I mean, obviously, there was meetings, and they were telling us about the Korean War and all this, and what was happening, and how the war was going on. I had no idea we would go. No.
Colchester.
I was still based in Colchester. They decided to give us the weekend off, leave. So they said before we went on weekend leave, the camp commander wasn't Carlin, Lieutenant Colonel Carlin, wasn't that? No, I can't remember. We had a visit from a Brigadier Brody. And we were formed up on the square, and he gave us a big lecture and this and that and this and that, talking about general things. And then he bluntly just said, "You're going on leave," he said, "because when you come back, you'll be doing basic training prior to going to Korea." And it came out of the blue.
Were you all shocked?
Well, no, I think the regular soldiers accepted it. I mean. They had the service of, say, 15, 20 years service. They accepted. But to us, we thought, well, the regiment's going to Korea. Oh, we're going on leave. Yeah. We won't be going to Korea. Why not? Well, we've only got another 6 months until we finish our service, national service. Came back off of leave, chatting away. My particular platoon was sat in the NAFI talking. And they said, well, you can't go to Korea because you've only, and the corporals and the sergeant would say, no, you can't come. And they thought, what a holiday we're missing. So he said, there's only one way you can go to Korea with the regiment, he said, is to sign on voluntarily. You can volunteer, put your name on a dotted line. Several days later, quite a few of us went and put our name on the dotted line, knowing that we only had 6 months to do. So we thought, out, 6 weeks back, we're not going to be in Korea very long. So we set sail for Korea.
I mean, some people didn't volunteer. They actually wanted to stay,
didn't they? Oh, yeah. I mean, they were sensible because they realised it. Oh, for whatever family commitments and the thought of going to a battle zone or whatever. They all didn't go, no. I mean, we said goodbye to quite a few friends. And the friends in comradeship that you get in, or in the army, maybe not today, but in our days, it was solid. You do anything for your mates. You do anything. If he couldn't pull his boots properly, get a shine on the toe cap, then you pull it for him. If he couldn't blank all his weapon, you'd do it for him. If he couldn't press his trousers correctly, you'd do it for him. And the comradeship, it was so great, it was unbelievable. Yeah.
What about the regulars as opposed to the National Service? Was there a bit of a divide?
Oh, no. No. No divide. No, I mean, in my platoon, there were set quite a few regular army people, and we got on well. Yeah.
And were there many Second World War veterans?
Yes. Oh, yes. Yes. Yes, there certainly was. I mean, when they used to come in and have their ribbons, I'm thinking, oh, where did you get that off from? You know, of course, they had National Service, they had campaign medals up and everything. And you look at his chest and he got 7 or 8 medals. What are you doing? Yeah. Oh, yeah. No, they were quite friendly and they talked to you.
Did they talk about what they've done? You know, what
like? Yeah. Oh, you don't know what it is. You youngsters don't know what it's like to be in the regular army at the moment. You got it soft. All right, maybe to them it was soft, but to us it was bloody grafting. It was grafting. Yeah, I mean, they said soft, but get your hair cut. I've had it cut, don't get it cut again.
What did your family think about you?
They didn't know.
You didn't tell them?
I didn't tell them. When I came home on leave, there hadn't been any leak out of news. So I said, right, I'm off to Jamaica then. I said goodbye to the family. Next thing I wrote them a letter saying, the boat's turned round the corner, I'm going to Korea. And it broke my mother's heart. Yeah. Oh no, I didn't tell them I was going. No.
That to save their feelings?
I know what my father would have done. He'd have given me the biggest licking of my life, really, you know. Yeah, he was right. Oh yes. Even though I was 18 and nearly 19 being there, he would have took me up and given me one big hiding. I was dead scared that he found out, but he didn't. But he was very gallant in the end. He wrote me a letter. He said, keep your head up and butt down and do what you're told.
Yeah. So you set off from Colchester?
Colchester, down to Southampton, onto the Wimpar Windrush, and set sail. They actually, on board the ship, they actually showed films of the Second World War and several battles, you know, but no, I didn't really know. I mean, I suppose in those days we were young. We were going to take 6 weeks to get to Korea, calling it various ports, going through the Straits of Gibraltar, going past the Rock of Gibraltar, going through the Mediterranean, the Suez Canal. Oh, it was exciting, yes, yes. Going out to Bay of Biscay, it was a rough time. 1 minute you were up in the air, the next minute you're down, and the people wanted to die because they were sick. And they actually give them injections to keep them out of the sickness, yeah.
But then it got a bit smoother as you went on.
Oh, actually, through the Mediterranean, calling is at the various ports of call on the way out to refurbished stores, Port Said, Port Suez, Colombo.
Were you allowed off at these places?
You could walk down a clam bank, the gang plank, and walk around, but you weren't allowed to go into towns or anything. Mm. No.
So, 6 weeks' time, you are coming into Busan?
No, if I could just go back.
Yes, certainly.
In those days, the Suez Canal was a one-way only. today is two ways. There's a bypass. We unfortunately got in the Suez Canal entrance at the wrong time. So we had to wait for a boat that was coming through from the air. So what did he do decide? Full marching order, off the boat, and a 3-hour march. In that weather. We'd never been in the hot country before, and they were, people were just dropping like flies. Because although we were fit, with full gear on, walking through that heat, carrying a rifle, it was unbelievable. Yes.
Why did they do that?
Give you something to do. Give you something to do. I've got something to say, but it might upset security of the company, England, because no armed ships are allowed to go through the Suez Canal. Armed ships. Maybe you might want to cut this. Our ship was armed. Camouflaged. Our 17-pounder was on top deck, screwed to the deck so it wouldn't move, because we needed to practice drill with that. Every day you practice different manoeuvres with the gun. Although we couldn't move the gun, we went through the actions of firing, engaging the enemy. Because we'd heard all about tank warfare over there. And we didn't arrive in Pusan, greenhorns. Alright, we were fully fledged anti-tank engineers, but needed that little something to give you. I mean, the riflemen were firing at targets at the back of the boat. The machine gunners were firing at targets off the back of the boat. We couldn't fire, obviously, but we needed, so they camouflaged it. And I've got a picture up there.
And do you have an idea of which sorts of tanks you were briefed on, what sort of tanks you'd be meeting?
Mainly the Russian T-34, which was a little powerful tank.
What was your opinion of it?
It was a quick tank. It was a very fast tank. And in fact, when we get round talking, then they showed us footage of T-34s. We used to wonder how the hell we're going to hit that. Oops. Yeah, but those were the only enemy tanks they had, was Russian T-34 tanks. Yeah.
So you arrived in Pusan.
We arrived to and the reception was call it terrific. Big American brass band playing Stars and Stripes and everything else. Got off the gangplank. And the Korean young ladies were given an apple to eat. So he formed up on the dock. I said, right, quick march, pick all your kit up and go. Right through then, into a train. No windows, no doors, no toilets. Everybody had to get on that. And that was my first introduction to Pusan. South Korea. It was, really, because basically, what had happened was that the war had turned nasty while we were on our way out there. And whereas it was supposed to be over by Christmas, it wasn't. And we were going to go up to the front line directly, green troops into the front line, 3 days by train, with no windows, no doors, no beds, no nothing. You slept where you sat.
Do you know about the date you actually arrived in Korea?
No, I don't. No. Okay. Yes.
Yeah.
We saw winter, so it must have been somewhere in about October, November, because we caught the first winter out there, yeah.
So, did you get much of a briefing from your officers,
Well, not really. No, you didn't get the actual briefing until we actually arrived in the front line, if you want to call it the front line, because it was just basically get off the train and start playing soldiers. Then the company commanders would call the sergeants and NCOs to a briefing, and then they'd call back, and our Corporal Chaz Bailey, his name just come to me, Corporal Chaz. Londoner, he'd come back and he said, right, so-and-so, this is what we're going to do. When? 23 hours, 11 o'clock in the evening, got on a fighting patrol.
So you got off the train, do you know where it was that you were first?
Tegu, I believe. Something called Tegu. It took us quite a long time to get up there.
What sort of countryside was it?
Hilly. Hilly. Yeah, valleys, narrow mud roads through the valleys.
Trees?
No trees. No. The trees of today have grown in the 50 years since. Yes. Bare bushes. There were obviously trees, but not in what they've got today over there. No. There are bushes and things.
So you set up your gun?
Yep. Set the gun up, and then said, right, we're now going to go patrolling. There are no tanks in the vicinity, we're going out on patrol. And that was my first introduction.
A night patrol. What was that like? How was that organised?
Follow the leader. Yeah. Live ammunition. You know, the magazine on your rifle of 10 rounds, one up the spout, we used to say, ready to fire if it was required. I suppose, really, when I look back on it, you're treating it as manoeuvres, really. Mm. You're not treating it as a fighting patrol. It hasn't come into it, you know, hasn't come into it yet. You're just going out, walk around, listen, patrol, sit down, take up fighting positions, all done on manoeuvres, came natural. Right, we're going back now, and come back anyway. And that was it. That was the main introduction to the actual South Korea, yes. Then, as you probably know, well, after the war, the tide turned and the Americans and fighting forces started to chase the North Koreans up towards the Yalu River. We went up to Pyongyang, which was the capital of North Korea in those days. And I shall never forget it, because the sergeant came up to me and he said, right, take your gun up there, bed it in. And take it up there, it was on this little hillock. Well, quite a big hillock, really. And old Dusty Miller came to me, he said, you all right? I said, yep. Right, come on with me. I said, yeah. So we about turned and started to walk backwards off this hillock. Can you drive through that? I said, drive through what? He said, those are little bushes and trees. I said, yeah, of course I can. Take the gun with us? I said, we can't leave the gun. We've got to take the gun with us. You can definitely go through, yeah, get down to the road. I said, why? He said, that's the bloody way we're going when we get challenged. Yeah, he was a regular, so we wouldn't have even dreamt of looking for an escape route. And then, of course, the big bug out came, as they call it. Well, stupid man, MacArthur, chased the Koreans over into China, didn't he? I mean, we were within hearing distance of the Yalu River, and we could hear the battle going and the guns firing. And he decided that he was going to chase those commies into China, and he did. He sent fighting patrols. Although they banked in on the dug in on the banks of the Yalu River, some fighting patrols actually went into China, and that's what brought the Chinese into the war. Had he stopped, the war would have ended. Or became a stalemate, or whatever. But the Chinese people's volunteers came into the war.
Did you fire your gun from that position?
No, we didn't. We had to give covering fire because there were no tanks. We didn't. In actual fact, we didn't fire anything at a tank in the whole of my career in Korea. All the tanks had been knocked out. Their supplies, when you see the war started in 1950 and you see footage of that and you see the tank battles going on and tanks being knocked out, well, when we got there weren't any tanks. No, whether that was a good thing or not, I don't know. But during the practice in the lull, the Centurion tank, which was our big tank, would target practice on knocked out tanks. But they found that anything under 200 yards bounced off the tank. Wouldn't penetrate. So they said to us, don't bother. So if it was under 200 yards, across the road, They could never have penetrated the tank. So that was it. As I say, we didn't never fire a shell in anger at a tank. The wheel tanks.
Had you encountered the enemy in any direct way by this time?
Oh, yes. Yeah. Yes. In patrolling, going out in patrols, a very thing that sticks in me at the moment is we go to this village. We go through the village, and the dogs bark. Nobody in the village. Now, we have to take prisoners, but no fighting, no shooting, take them alive. Out the village, back up the hill, dig in. And in the moonlight, we can see something moving. And the dog started barking. And I've got a dog that barks over the back here. And every time that dog barks, I'm back there. It's true, that is, yes. Fortunately, they didn't come our way, which could have been a good thing. Or well, bad thing is the case with me, but they went the other way and they said, well, we're not going to penetrate anymore, we're going back. We had several skirmishes prior to the big battle. The Americans had been blasting hell out of this hill 3-7 by its height. They'd taken 3 foot off the top of it, shelling it. And my sergeant came to me, he said, you're going up the hill 3-7. All right, sir. You're going up as an ammunition carrier for the machine guns, which was a box. Carrying up and so, gets halfway up there, nothing. And I can't say what Corporal Chaz said, because it's so foul, it's unbelievable. What it resulted was that they sent us up the wrong blinking hill. They'd been knocking 7 colours off this hill. They were shooting it in the wrong hill. Yeah. The enemy, 3-7, was the next hill over.
The enemy must have pulled the enemy. They must be watching us.
I went down and sat there. Anyway, they decide now, we come down, we have a refreshment, and go to take 3 hill to 3-7, which has now been, it's a virgin hill. Nothing's been done to it. And we lost quite a few people up there. Mm. Yeah.
So you went up with machine
guns? Yeah. I didn't actually go into the front, because I was an ammunition carrier. Mm. But I wasn't very far from it. Mm. And just, we
how
lost.
How many people went up there then?
I think 2 or 3 platoons went up, which was about 190 men. Then we lost 3 or 4 blokes up there. Yeah. And when they found, eventually we took the hill, and if they had been firing at the hill, they would never knock the enemy out, because the enemy was dug in behind the back of the hill. That was one of the mess ups in my life and career. Well, we were following, basically following what the Americans were telling us to do. I mean, they wanted the dirt done. They said, told us to do the dirt, you know. That was my opinion in those days, because they bring, as I say, we do a standby and let them come through, back through us. And then we'd have to come out of the particular battle zone ourselves. And then we should be sent back into the battle zone again. No Americans, us, our regiment. And you think yourself, oh, we've just come out of here, what are we going back for? And that was to bed in and take it, yeah, to stop the offence. Yeah.
So you felt that the British Army was sort of working underneath the...
Oh, yeah, they were under the American command, yeah, there was no doubt about it.
It felt like that.
Yeah, it did, yes, yeah.
Ben Whitchurch, end of reel 2.